excited to be here to kind of talk a little bit big picture on how we've been using modified engineered soils in the turf industry for about 50 years. Some of the first recommendations or specifications for how to build these modified turf soils occurred in 1973, I think, the first time the USGA came out with a recommendation. And so over that time, we really discovered that what's working and what's not working in terms of how we are building these soils. We're continually revising our recommendations over the last 50 years. And then the management perspective is really, really important, because you can build the soil, but if we're not managing it into an effective way, all of a sudden all the benefits that we've associated with the design and all the costs that we've put to build the soil starts to decay away or decline. So this is research that I wanted to highlight. Came from a couple different labs. Rock Aswal is my predecessor. He's the department head at Nebraska. He's done a lot of research on organic matter. Glenn O'Bear is my PhD student, who got his master's degree with Doug Soldat at Wisconsin, looking at iron layer and clay layer formations in these soils. And so I kind of wanted to do a big picture on how we build these and some of the problems that are arising and things that we have to consider from our management to keep these soils performing properly. So this is Doug Soldat's lawn. We moved in. The house was just built, and they put an inch of soil on top of this, and then they sodded it. And it's not surprising that turf site is going to need a lot of inputs to be acceptable. If we're starting off with this type of a situation, compacted, full of rubble, sticks, and everything else, construction debris, that's a big issue that plagues our urban soils and plagues our lawns in urban environments. It kind of gives the lawn the reputation that it needs so much inputs, because we're trying to grow it on a situation in a soil that really is not suited to grow any type of a plant very effectively. We also have challenges with compaction in turf. People are walking across our turf. That's why one reason we have turf, so it can handle the traffic and defoliation and still grow with the subapical meristem. But that leads to compaction, especially in places like athletic fields, soccer goal mouths. And that compaction can be so extreme that the plants can't perform. And also now with the risk of concussions, these fields can get so compacted that they can become very hard, and so we have an increase of risk of concussions to our athletes, and that's a bigger and bigger deal. I'm sure we're all well aware of that in NFL and in college sports, and making its way down into high school, into junior sports. Another issue that we have is, a lot of times we don't have just perfectly pitched or graded turf areas. We want to have slopes for playability and performance of these different turf areas. This is a putting green, it's a native soil green, and so we get a big heavy rainfall, and we don't have the infiltration, so that water pools up in those low places, and people want to golf right away, and so they want to get out there, and they're compacting the soil. It's you can see how close the flag stick is there. We have very concentrated levels of traffic next to these very, very saturated soils, and it leads to the decline in soil health, and then the decline in our turf grass health. So in the 70s, the USGA came out with a panel of experts and created their recommendations for sand-based, we call them root zones in the turf industry. That's just the term that's been adopted. And so if you hear root zone or see root zone, it's just means it's the place where the roots of the grass grow. So that could be a native soil, or in this situation, it's going to be an engineered blended type of a soil. And the reason we've gone to sand, as I'm sure you're all well aware, is that they are great at resisting compaction, and they have good infiltration. And that's really what we're looking for in a high-performing turf soil, something that water can get through so we can get on the surface again and use it for its intended purpose, and then resist that compaction. And so sand is generally how we achieve that. And so the USGA recommendation for how to build, initially it was putting greens, and now it's been adapted to tees and athletic fields, and all the athletic fields you see on TV for different sports, many of them are built like big putting greens, acres of putting green, which you'll have 50 centimeters of sand on top of a 10 centimeter gravel blanket, and then there's drain tile lines underneath that. One of the reasons you might wonder why do we have this, you know, why is it 30 centimeters? One of the reasons is because you want to have as much area there to hold water, so you have an increase in plant available water. But also, the cup of a golf course is 8 inches deep. And so you have some issues there too, where playability has been important into the design of these soils. And so when you see this same design, for example, used for an athletic field where you're not putting a hole in it every single day, do you need to have that depth of sand? Because that can have issues with it being droughty. The big advantage that the USGA specification recommendation has is this textural discontinuity. We have this fine textured soil on top of a coarse textured gravel. There's very specific bridging requirements to make sure that both those soils don't start to intermix too much. And that textural discontinuity leads to this zone of preferential water holding. We'll call it the perched water table in the turf industry. So if you hear that, that's what they're talking about. Although Rock will remind us that it's technically not a perched water table in the truest sense of the word. It is a hanging water column that is suspended, is preferentially held due to the textural discontinuity there. But the thought is it's going to help hold a little bit of moisture so that we can have a little bit more water holding in the sand, and then we get a big rainfall, the gravitational forces of the water then allow that water to quickly infiltrate, and then we get this reestablishment of this perched water table. In actuality, this perched water table is usually about 7 millimeters in thickness because of the coarseness of the sand. And so what we see is a lot of moisture held up in the surface where the organic matter is, and then it's kind of dry in between, and then we have higher levels of moisture down at this sand gravel interface. And so talk about depths, that's why you say, is 12 inches, is 30 centimeters really appropriate? Maybe something that's a little thinner. And so the USGA is constantly revising these, and we're trying to look at different depths and things like that. Like a traditional spec, it has very specific quantities for the different sand components, and most of the sand in this USGA spec is going to be a minimum 60% coarse to medium sands, you can have up to about 3% clay. So mainly coarse medium sands with less fines coarse gravel. So again, you have a situation where compaction risk is going to be minimized. One thing that we have to consider, a lot of the golf course superintendents think about a lot, is the shape of the sand particles. A lot of the cheap sand is river sand, it's beach sand, very round, well-rounded sand particles, and we don't have much strength there. So that's a big deal, especially to new turf sites, because that you walk across it, you're playing on it, it's just soft. And so superintendents, a lot of times, will look for subangular or angular sand, which generally has to be crushed. It's much more energy intensive, but a lot of our sources come from, and so that locks together a lot more and gives a little bit more support. Another way we can increase the support in these modified root zones is to amend them with some type of an amendment. Typically, it's an organic amendment like peat. It's usually amended at between 10 and 20% by volume to increase water holding and nutrient holding, especially in those first couple of years when there's not much organic matter in that situation. Less common, we can amend this profile with inorganics, calcined clay, zeolites, things like that. And the only specification on how much is there is we have to hit, again, physical thresholds. We need to have total porosities between 35 and 55%. And the toughest one thing we need to make sure we reach is the USGA recommends at least 6 inches of infiltration rate per hour. Most of these root zones are perking at about 30 to 40 inches of water per hour at construction, but that rapidly declines, especially on how you're managing that turf grass. Another benefit of using the peat, this is a green we're establishing right now, and we have different fertilizer rates with and without peat. So the foreground of this picture, that is just straight sand meeting the USGA recommendation. In the background, that is sand with peat amended, seeded at the exact same time, irrigated the same, and you can see the benefits of the water and nutrient holding. And with that peat side, that grass is completely established in 6 weeks. The foreground there, it's been 6 weeks and it's nowhere near an acceptable putting green situation. So now we're seeing this type of putting green construction being expanded across all turf areas and urban soils. This is the National Mall. A lot of people would call it a national eyesore for a while because it was highly compacted native soil. They had it's the most visited national park. Just for example, there was 1.1 million people there for Obama's inauguration in 2009, causing a lot of compaction and wear on that turf grass in addition to all the other events that they have there. So the Parks Department has taken the book from, or taken a page from the USGA's start, and they also built the pretty much a putting green for the entire National Mall. And so this is the profile. They have a mainly sand-based mix brought in. You have irrigation, drainage, we have kind of a gravel layer. They don't have the perch water table as much per se, but it's definitely a huge project, and the sheer cost is enormous. So if you're going to put $700 million into making your lawn look pretty good, then you need to make sure that you're doing the right steps to keep it functioning the way that it's been designed to function. So here's kind of a picture as that project is finally wrapping up. It's been several years in the making, and it looks pretty darn nice. But these turf soils, they can definitely fail, and so that's what a lot of our research has been. And they fail mainly because we get layer formation that's going to impact infiltration and drainage characteristics of these turf grasses. Either it's going to be infiltration through the grass canopy, and we get drying and death from that side of things. And now we're doing more research and we're discovering that layers are forming even deeper in the canopy, in the soil. And so that's leading to saturated conditions, which are not healthy for roots and are causing a lot of death. So the number one thing that we've been studying, because it's the most obvious and because it really impacts playability, is organic matter accumulation. We can very, very rapidly build up organic matter levels in these sandy soils. And because of their properties, we just don't see a lot of turnover of that organic matter. So it just kind of sits there. And so if we're not diluting it, we can have some serious problems. More recently, we've been discovering iron and clay layer formations that started to occur in these profiles also. And so I wanted to show a little bit of research on these main causes here for decline and failure of our turf. Another commonly cited source of failure, though, is bicarbonate accumulation due to poor irrigation water quality. And so I wanted to just take a couple of slides to address that, because that's a situation where we have a lot of growers thinking there's a problem, but from a research perspective, we cannot actually ever simulate bicarbonate sealing of a very coarse to medium sand root zone. So first with the organic matter, turf grass plants are really, really good at accumulating carbon and putting it in the soil. This is some century modeling research that was done at Colorado State, where they took native grassland soils from around the Colorado area and they simulated what happens when you put a lawn on it. And you can see a very rapid increase in total soil organic carbon. And that's because we're managing them very intensively. A native grassland in eastern Colorado is in pretty dry, arid environment. We put turf there, and to meet the recommendations and expectations of that turf, we're going to be fertilizing it, we're going to be watering it, we're going to be mowing it to stimulate growth, and so all of those processes are going to lead to a very rapid accumulation of carbon in any kind of a turf soil. And so it could be a native soil, and especially problematic in these highly engineered sand-based soils. And so this is a putting green research that my predecessor, my department head, did in the late 90s, where they looked at organic matter accumulation in these sand root zones on putting greens. And so at year one, this isn't going to work, I guess. There we go. So year one, we can see there's not much organic matter except for at the very surface. Year two, four, and then you get to year eight, we have a very dense layer of organic matter there. We battle hydrophobicity issues a lot in these sandy soils, so surfactant applications are pretty much a necessity, especially as the soil starts to dry down. And so we see a big reduction in infiltration rate. Over the course of 11 years, we had greens that were perking at 60-70 centimeters per hour or greater, and they declined to 11 centimeters of water per hour. So a huge reduction in just a few years due to this accumulation of organic matter. And we also start to see a disparity in the vertical distribution of the water, because that water is being held up in this upper part of that profile, and then we start to see dry down in the intermediate depths of the profile, and then we see again that saturated zone down at the sand gravel interface. But our roots aren't going to want to, you know, push into those areas that are pretty dry. And so all of a sudden now we have mainly majority of our root mass up in the top of the soil. We're not even able to use all of that water as effectively in our plant available water. And my argument actually starts to go down a little bit. So we can see these layers forming. This is very excessive levels of organic matter accumulation in these sand-based soils. And so this can have a dramatic, again, impact on our turf grass health and then the soil's physical properties. And if you're going to spend $2 million to build 3 acres of putting greens, you know, you don't want to have this occur in the matter of, you know, 10 years and have to think about rebuilding those surfaces. So what I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with, maybe in your own lawn, is you think about aerating. Is this a way we can try to manage organic matter? Is to try to pull those cores up and take the organic matter away? It's funny, everyone's talking about sequestering carbon in turf. We can sequester so much carbon, we're trying to get rid of it, but we don't know what to do with it. It's causing issues. The problem is, if you look at this figure, we're not really impacting a large percentage of that surface, right? Maybe less than 10% of the surface is being impacted. And so as you're trying to remove organic matter and sustain lower organic matter from high infiltration, removing with core aerification really isn't a very great and effective tool. If you have a couple different setups here, I'm sorry for the English units, this is an extension slide, but the take-home note is, you know, even in the best case scenario, we're probably hitting about 5% of that surface is being impacted by, you know, vertically removing the organic matter. So a more effective way that we've taken in turf is to be very aggressive with sand top dressing. Rock will say dilution is the solution to the pollution. The same thing is going on here. We have this organic matter. We need to continue to add sand to turn that into a situation where we can sustain a lot better infiltration rates and prevent these thick layers from occurring. And so sand top dressing is a big part of the maintenance of these profiles. So you put it down, we brush it in, and it doesn't disrupt golf too much. But you have to do it, you know, every single week. It's a continual process, and a fair amount of sand is being applied to try to match. Usually it's about a centimeter or so of sand depth needs to be applied every year just to match the accumulation of thatch and organic matter by that turf grass plant. We still recommend aeration, but we like to use solid tines because that helps improve a gas exchange in that profile, and so poking holes very frequently also helps to maintain high infiltration rates and to help with gas exchange in those profiles and improve oxygenation. But we just don't recommend pulling the cores. We'd rather just continue with the aggressive top dressing. We've even used high pressure water injection. This machine is pretty much like a pressure washer, and it drives around, and every time it makes a clicking sound, high pressure water is getting blasted into that profile to try to increase the infiltration and aeration of the profile. And so now the other issue what we're just discovering is formations of iron and clay layers at the textural boundaries of these root zones. My PhD students gave a couple talks about that here, and so I'm not going to sit and rehash everything that he's done. I just wanted to draw some awareness to them. We're finding these layers of iron oxide forming at the interface of the sand and the gravel. It's very, very marked. You can pick it up in sheets. And what it essentially does is it causes the turf to fail because now we can't drain anymore. If we get a lot of irrigation, a lot of rain, all of a sudden it turns essentially into a bathtub. It becomes very reducing, low oxygen environment, the roots die and the turf starts to die. And so it's a huge concern, and we can get it to occur in 5 years. And so you can go from a brand new green to a green that is not draining in a very, very short amount of time. We've seen it across the entire country. It's been characterized. You'll notice there's a big gap in the middle part of the country. That's just because they didn't sample there. It was by no means a complete sampling. They just wanted to see how pervasive this was, and it was found to be found through a broad ranges of soil construction material, pHs and sizing, and suppliers, and so it seems to be a greater and greater problem. It seems like every year we're learning more and more about this. Looking at some of the profiles, we saw that iron levels as we go down, they were pretty low, about 2%, and then all of a sudden we hit that sand gravel interface, and we see this BSM horizon forming, where we're having the iron cementing the organic matter, the clay, and the silt together to form this impermeable layer. Also, soil organic carbon. Again, we have a lot of organic carbon at the surface. Then it's pretty devoid of carbon to the middle of the profile, and then we see again an increase in carbon. We're assuming that's from dissolved organic carbon interacting with the iron and starting to precipitate at that boundary. We also see that pH is pretty important to this. So we had pretty high pHs, and then pH dropped until we got to where it hit the high pH sand or gravel, and then we led to a big pH change, which also might be helping change the redox state of that chemistry. Okay, so I just wanted to wrap up with that. We see the same issues with clay layers forming in these profiles. It looks very much like iron, and so that's definitely a concern. I didn't think I was going to take this long to go over this, so I apologize. I'm happy to answer questions. Answer your questions during the show at the end. But we're thinking about considering organic matter properties of sand and gravel when we're constructing this. Looking also at the chemical and not just on the physical properties, and then making sure we're doing adequate maintenance and management so that we don't lose the performance of these really high value and very expensive type soil. So sorry about that, and I hope you can have some interesting questions for me later. Thank you.